And then there's a loading screen, and then the preloading screen, and the animation, and a guy says, "Welcome!" And you're like, "No, I was playing this like 3 seconds ago." This is Up Up Down Down, the show about the craft of video games that you can bring with you anywhere. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked at Radical Entertainment, now Activision. And he's currently the co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
We're also thrilled to welcome Mike Hurley of 5x5. Mike hosts more podcasts than any person alive, including his interview show, Command Space, and his games podcast, Directional. Hi, Mike.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, we're thrilled to have you. Very exciting. So our topic today is portable consoles. What is their future? What is their present? What makes a good portable console game? What makes a bad one? And are we going to even have these things in 5 years? And so, you know, I've been listening to some episodes of Directional, and Mike's been often mentioning not just the DS, which is sort of the portable console king of the last many years, but also the Vita. You have both. That's true, right, Mike? You have both.
Yeah, yeah. I have both. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought I'd kick it off to Mike for, you know, what is it about these portable consoles that you love that is actually, you know, makes it such a big part of your gaming?
It's interesting. Like, I do tend to play portable consoles more than traditional consoles, TV consoles. I have an Xbox One, but I play my PSP primarily for most games. Like, that's where I enjoy gaming. And I think it's a bit like the portability, so I can take my games with me wherever I go. And I think in the same way that, like, I enjoy my iPhone and my iPad, like, having everything in my hand and the screen right in front of my face, there's like a feeling that I get when I play these games. Like, I'm more involved, like, I'm controlling it more because it's right in my hands. Like, I'm moving it around and the screen's moving around with me and stuff like that. So I think that there's like a thing for me where that works. And also, the games that are made for those consoles are the games that I tend to enjoy more. So, like, platform games or fun games that you can play for like 5 minutes or 2 hours. I like some sort of RPG games, and I really like this style of like bringing the old style of video games. So like games that you would play on the NES or like stuff like that. Like that sort of style, like the left to right side scrolling of some kind. Like there's a game, one of my favorite games this year is a game called Olly Olly, which is like a cross between like a platformer and a skateboarding game on the PSP.
And yeah, I've heard you guys talking about this, but when you're saying PSP, do you mean PSP or do you mean like the Vita?
I meant the PS Vita. I don't know why I said PSP.
And said a couple times, but I was like, I'm not exactly, maybe they're compatible or something. I'm not a world expert.
No, it's definitely the Vita. I don't know why I'm saying PSP, but it's the Vita. I'm a Vita owner, and it's my favorite console, and I love it. Like, I love how big the screen is, and it's really bright, and I can download all the games, like, because I like to just be able to download games rather than buying games and having them all over the place. And yeah, so for me, that works. And the games that are there at the moment, a lot of the indie games are just fantastic. And PlayStation's doing a really, really good job of attracting the indie developers.
Yeah, there was actually, I mentioned Directional already, but one of the very recent episodes of Directional, you had one of the people responsible at PlayStation for, you know, getting those games on the Vita, and listening to him talk with passion about, okay, well, no, this is the kind of games that we want, and we're going to get these really fun indie games. And Shahid Ahmad was his name.
Yeah, and Shahid is awesome.
Yeah, he's really awesome, and he just had so much passion for all these types of games. I mean, I guess that's his job, but it made me kind of curious. I'm like, well, what am I missing out on these Vita games? So it's interesting, that idea that there's kind of a category of game that works on those that we're just not getting, you know, or at least I'm not getting, not having a portable console.
Do you think it's actually that those games don't work on the bigger consoles, or is it just that the sort of lower power of the Vita, and that people are sort of used to buying download games, just kind of makes it a better market for those games? Like, that they would work fine on the big consoles, but it hasn't been something that's sort of caught on yet, though certainly it seems like Sony's making some moves in that direction with the PS4. Like, the PS4 is way indie friendlier than previous TV consoles have been.
I think they work because they're small games, they're light games, that, you know, they're meant to be played in this way. Like, they're built for to be mobile, in that, you know, you can jump in and jump out. But it's interesting that you mentioned, like, what PlayStation's doing at the moment. A bunch of my favorite games that I've played on the Vita recently, like Guacamelee and Olly Olly, they're now going to the PS4. So, like, Sony, I believe, is, like, courting these developers and helping them to... They had a good Vita hit, and now they want them on the PlayStation as well. And I'm seeing more and more of that. It's really interesting to see, like, such and such game is coming to, and such and such, you know, to the PS4 now. And that it seems like they're really trying to cultivate these indie developers to make for both platforms. And they've got, like, the cross-play thing, which is just magical. Like, I need to buy a PS4. Like, so, like, for Fez, they've just released Fez on the Vita. If you have Fez on the PS4, like, it cross, like, you can play it on the PlayStation and it saves your game to the cloud, to the PlayStation network, and then you can pick it up on your Vita and just leave the house and play. Like, that just seems like the dream scenario. I love that.
There are some games that use that the PSP Vita as, like, a second screen, sort of in the style of the Wii U gamepad,
yeah,
from what I understand. I mean, I have neither a Vita nor a PS4 yet, but yeah. From what I understand, there's certainly a lot of that going on. And I mean, that is a convenient way to do things. Like, as much as the Wii U's got some issues, like, having the gamepad and having all the games required to sort of work with the gamepad certainly does give you a different experience availability of, like, yeah, you don't need the TV in order to play the game. You can just keep playing the game on the Wii U gamepad. And it's, you know, it's not portable in the sense that, like, the Vita is. You can't take it anywhere, but you can take it around the house a little bit. And most significantly, like, if the kids want to play something and my wife wants to watch TV, she can say, no, go keep playing on the gamepad and go sit in the corner and put your headphones on. And it's it gives you more flexibility in terms of that stuff, which obviously mobile gaming does that to an even greater degree, right? You're not limited by being within close Wi-Fi range of the base station for it to work. You can kind of take that experience and pick it up anywhere. And that's something that I think is pretty significant with these portable consoles. I see it more with my kids. Like, I'm not a like hardcore portable gamer myself. Most of my gaming on the go is, like, lightweight iPhone kind of gaming. But my kids all have DSs, and they like them, I think, for almost exactly the same reason that you do, right? That they're something that they can take with them but still have a big gaming experience on, right? Because they're willing to commit more to those kind of experiences. They don't want some little iPhone game that they can play and just kind of discard and stuff like that. They want to play a real game. They want to be able to, like, go over to their friend's house and play, you know, multiplayer Pokemon battles over there and stuff like that. Things that aren't those kind of throwaway sort of experiences that you sometimes get with the phone games.
Yeah.
And that was the genesis of the portable console. You know, the original Game Boy, not that all people with Game Boys were kids, but I think the really big driving force behind it was, well, we only have one TV and I'm watching the news, so I need something so the kid can do something too, you know, or, you know, another person in the house. Basically, it's a lot more practical to have multiple Game Boys than it has to have multiple big CRT, you know, tubes. So, you know, that's something that is less true now. I think it's a lot more common for people to have multiple TVs in the house. It's more common for people to have a lot of screens. Like, I would imagine the average house in, you know, the Game Boy was, like, 1988 or something, the average house probably had one or maybe two screens in it. And the average house now has probably, what, 5, 10, 100, depending on, yeah, if it's Nigel's house.
It depends on what you consider a screen.
We have a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. That's, I think, one of the things, that's the two-sided thing about this question of, as more tablets and phones and, you know, iOS devices are permeating people's homes, is that particular market where it's kids who just don't have a screen, is that a long-term thing, or is it more of just a legacy of the fact they want to play Pokemon and you can only get Pokemon on the DS because Nintendo is smart about licensing?
I think it's a lot more the latter. I don't think that it's currently that kids are getting the DS because they don't have access to any other screens, though it could be that the DS is the only screen that they have exclusive access over. Like, all of my kids have got their own iPads, largely because I get so much hand-me-down hardware from work that I can afford to do that. I don't have to buy them all brand new ones. But, I mean, that's a pretty ridiculous scenario, right? Most people are not going to get all of their children their own iOS devices. There's a big price difference there. The cheapest DSs are around $100, and the cheapest iOS devices, the iPod Touches, are around $200, and you got to go up to around $300 to get like the cheapest iPad. And that's a pretty big gulf for something that a kid can break easily. And the DSs are a lot more rugged than iOS devices are. A kid can drop them and not damage them. So I think even, you know, in the past, maybe it was, yeah, this is the kids' only screen that they have complete control over. It still might be that to some degree, or at least the only screen that they have exclusive control over. But I think for kids that are gamers, like I said, it gives you an experience that you really still can't get on iOS. If you want that, like, deeper experience, the game that you can sit down and play for a couple hours at a stretch, the same sort of experience that grown-ups are looking for from consoles, it's often more convenient for kids to get that with their DSs, because then they can take them in the car on long car trips, and they can take them over to their friend's house, and the multiplayer just works, even if they're not hooked up to the Wi-Fi network over at their friend's house. And there's all sorts of things about the gaming experience on the DS that are way better if the kids actually care about gaming.
The interesting distinction there of being able to sit down for hours and get really into a game being something special about the actual consoles, though, that's more of an artifact. The fact that you can't do that on an iOS device, say, is more an artifact of what kind of games you can get on the App Store than it is something fundamental, you know, about it being a console as opposed to a tablet, right? Like, there are some you can get, you know, some of the old Final Fantasy games, and, you know, there's no reason you couldn't have Pokemon. We talked about this in a previous episode. Pokemon would be a great iPhone or iPad game. Like, it doesn't have any Twitch controls. You don't need joysticks. It's just, like, turn-based, tap kind of stuff, you know? I think that's the most sort of the strangest thing about the current situation as far as kids go. Whereas, like, for adults, I think are more likely to be particularly interested in, like, a game like Ollie Ollie. From my understanding of it, it's pretty, like, reflexes based. You're going to have to do really quick input. And so actually having physical buttons makes the game. Like, it wouldn't be a very good iPad game at all.
Yeah, Ollie Ollie started life as an iOS game.
Oh, really? Okay, so I'm really wrong.
No, but they realized that they couldn't do what they wanted to do. Like, it was never released.
Oh, okay,
so
interesting.
It started life as an iOS game, and they realized that they couldn't make the game that they wanted to make on just a touchscreen. They needed buttons for the Twitch controls, because it's very much like that. Like, you have to do combos and stuff with the analog sticks, and you have to hit buttons at just the right time to land your tricks and stuff like that. So they believed that controller, like a hardware controls, would actually be better than doing it on a touchscreen. And I think a lot of games are like that. Like, I agree, Pokemon could work, I think, on touch devices, like on a phone or a tablet. But Mario, I don't think could.
Platforming with touchscreens is terrible.
Exactly. So I think that if we want to play these types of games, and history says that people kind of do, we need to continue to have these devices, in my opinion. And it may be that, you know, I actually personally think that handheld consoles will be around for longer than TV consoles.
Oh, that's interesting. What makes you think that?
I think that it's, to say easier is the wrong term, but I just think that companies like Apple, Amazon would be better served that they'll be able to replicate that experience a lot easier. Companies, for third parties, could make controllers, you know, because a controller is easier to make than a handheld gaming console. So you could have this just really powerful machine that can run all this sort of stuff, you know, in the same way that you could hook a PC up to your TV. But I feel like that a console, like a handheld console, takes a lot more expertise to pull off, to get the controls correct and stuff like that. You know, you've only, the company that makes the screen and all the stuff that goes inside is the same company that makes the buttons and all the stuff that goes on the outside. And I feel like that the kid element is a big part in this. Like, you know, you guys were, you know, you were mentioning about how kids in the car, right? That's a big thing, I think, about why stuff like the DS works. Because I think that if you look at playing Mario, playing Pokemon at home, and then being able to throw the kids in the back of the car to go on the car trip. I think, Nigel, you mentioned that your kids play their games in the car. I think that's...
They do a lot of DS gaming.
Yeah.
Not so much on short car rides, but on long car rides, yep, for sure. When they know we're going somewhere that's going to be hours in the car, they want to get their DS's charged and have games on them, because they know it's not just, oh, we're going to be in the car for a few minutes and whatever, I can just not do anything or play a game on one of the grown-up cell phones or something like that. It's like, nope, we're going to be sitting for an hour or two at a stretch, and so we want a serious gaming experience.
And like, take a look at the way that those devices are made. Like, if you look at the way, if you compare the materials that a DS or a PS Vita are made out of compared to what an iPhone is made out of, they're made to be used in this way. Like, they're thicker and chunkier, so they feel better in the hand and have longer battery life, and they can incorporate, you know, buttons and stuff and close up like the DS can. They're made out of materials that can be dropped, and they don't necessarily smash and shatter all over the place because it's plastic rather than glass. The design challenges are completely different, and the designers are able to lend their expertise to create devices that are more purpose-built for the environment. So, you know, we want our phones to be made of really nice material, and we want them to be small and light and thin, which is not necessarily how people want their portable gaming consoles, especially if they're going to be played by children. You know, I feel like you're much better placed giving a kid a DS than your iPhone. If it gets...
Oh, for sure.
You know, and also the price difference. An iPhone will cost you $600 to replace, and a DS, you know, you can probably pick them up for pretty cheap, especially pre-owned, you know. And so I think that they're the sort of the markets why this stuff will continue to exist, and I think that there's a chance that this stuff will continue for longer than the consoles, because a lot of consoles are made by the companies that make other stuff, you know. So Sony could start putting these things into TVs, and Microsoft could start building PCs, right, that double up as Xboxes. But these devices, they have their own little niche carved out that I think isn't going away.
I think there's also an interesting argument. I don't know if I entirely believe it, but I think it's interesting that portable devices can replace fixed position devices to a degree that's not true the other way, right? With the right setup, you can have like a portable console that when you say, yeah, I want big screen, I want big sound, you do like the second screen kind of thing of connect it to the TV in some way and play with the portable device in your hand acting as the controller, but you're looking at the thing playing on the TV. And there are definitely issues with that. It's going to be hard for portable devices to match the raw power of the consoles ever, basically. Like, you know, you'll always be able to make a better console that connects to a TV than one that you got to be able to carry around.
Yeah.
But you can fill that need, right? If you say, yeah, I want to be able to game, I want to have a physical controller, I want to be able to game on my TV, a portable console can potentially fill that need for you. But if you say, I want to be able to game on the go, a TV connected console is basically never going to be able to do significantly better than the Wii U does with, yeah, you can play in the next room on the portable portion of the console and you don't have to have the real TV turned on. You're not going to be able to in a reasonable amount of time. I mean, maybe you know, maybe really distant future, all of the internet connections will be fast enough that all of the smarts for everything can just be offsite somewhere, and you can take your, you know, take your iPad equivalent with you and have it connect to a way more powerful machine off in the cloud somewhere and play the game that way. But that future's pretty far away, whereas the future of being able to stream from a local portable console to a TV that's a few feet away and have that be responsive enough to be playable, you can build that setup now. It's just not mainstream. It's something that you gotta put work into constructing to some degree. And it's expensive, because you either need a really expensive portable device, or you need a portable device that's designed to work with a console, like the Vita PS4 situation or something like that. But that stuff will get more mainstream, I think.
I agree with you there, Nigel, especially the bit that you were saying about the device, like you could plug a portable device into a television and pick up the controller that you have, right? And I agree, like, that the difference between what the power and that can be given from a, like, a home console compared to a portable console, there will always be a gap. But I feel like now that gap is smaller than it's ever been. You know, these portable devices are able to power some pretty impressive looking stuff, and I feel like it's not that the distance between the two of them has in the past been further. And now, like, you look at something like what an iPad can play, like a game that an iPad, you know, and how great they look. And then you look at what a games console like a PlayStation 4 can do. And of course, it's a massive difference, but it's closer than it's ever been.
Well, it's not as much of a difference as you would think necessarily. Like, Nigel and I often talk about when a new graphics generation comes out, new iPads or whatever, I'm always like, okay, so how fast is that compared to a PlayStation 3? And now it's kind of like, well, I don't know, iPad Air, PlayStation 3, like some are, one's faster at some things, the other's faster at other things. And yeah, PlayStation 3 is previous generation, but it's not that much slower than the PS4, considering that it's how much older it is.
Which is insane.
Yeah.
Also, as hardware gets more powerful, the importance of the relative difference in power becomes less important, right? Even if you look at current portable devices and current console devices and say, all right, what's the power differential relative to the previous one? My suspicion is the power differential is lower. That's like, you know, 10 years ago it was 50 times slower and now it's like 20 times slower, something like that. I don't know if those are the exact numbers, but somewhere in those kind of ballparks. But the absolute power does matter too, right? That we're still in the early days of computing power relative to where computing power is going to be in like 50 years or 100 years. And for most of our gaming lives, you know, machines that you could plug into power were on one side of the bar of like minimal acceptable quality, and portable devices were on the other side. And now portable devices have kind of crossed over. Like, portable devices are at the point where you can make stuff that looks really good on portable devices, which you couldn't really back in the original DS or Game Boy Advance kind of era. Of there was an obvious difference in what kind of stuff you could make on the portable consoles versus what you can make on the home consoles. And yeah, maybe the gap hasn't narrowed, but the portable consoles have gotten past a hump where now they can do like full 3D and lots of objects on screen and lots of effects, and they've got nice graphics hardware. And it's, you know, it's not as significant that they're underpowered relative to the consoles.
So that's definitely true. And then, you know, the Nintendo DS and the Game Boy original especially were way underpowered compared to, you know, the things you could do on a full-fledged PC, game PC, or on a home console. But, and so I would agree that, you know, the gaming experience is getting closer, but the Nintendo DS and the original Game Boy are two of the top three best-selling consoles of all time. So I'm not entirely, like, I buy that, yeah, the experience feels like it's getting closer, but I'm not necessarily sure that I buy that the fact that it's getting fast enough is somehow helping the health of this or the sales of these devices.
Well, I think the point here is not so much that it's necessarily helping the sales of those devices. It's that it could theoretically put those devices in a situation where they could take on the home console market. It's not so much about how those devices do in a vacuum as how they do relative to consoles you hook up to your TV. That, you know, that's sort of the point I was making, is now we're getting to the point where a lot of people could get the gaming experience that they want from a home console out of their portable device, which they couldn't before. And will that increase the portable devices sales? Yeah, to some degree. It's not going to help that much, given that portable consoles already sell really well, and lots of people that have portable consoles also have home consoles, but it could do damage to the home console industry. It could be that rather than more general purpose devices like iPhones and iPads taking out home consoles, that what takes out home consoles is actually portable dedicated gaming devices, because they've got that flexibility. Like I said, I'm not even entirely sure I believe that argument, but I think it's an interesting point. Like, I think that there's something there. And you can see this in kind of what's happened with this console generation, that, you know, lots of people were ragging on Nintendo with, like, oh, you know, their sales are tanking and it's iPhones and iPads that are the cause of it, right? That those devices are stealing mindshare. But, you know, what you can see from the sales numbers is that, like, yeah, they've been hurt, but it's the portable devices that you would expect to be the ones that are hurt the most by this competition from other mobile devices are the ones that are actually doing well. Like, the 3DS is not doing amazing compared to the DS, but it's doing fine. It's the Wii U that's tanking. And that, you know, it's not clear why that should be hurt by competition from mobile devices more than other mobile devices are. And I think that this aspect of mobile devices can do the things that consoles can, but consoles can't do the thing that mobile devices can, and general purpose devices can't always do the thing that mobile devices or consoles do because they don't have the physical controls.
Yeah, I think that the sort of commentary you're mentioning about that, you know, they should just give up because obviously iOS devices and, you know, these sort of things are going to destroy the console market. That sort of whole thing started, or just like a round of it started with when the Nintendo 2DS came out. And John Gruber famously said, oh, they should just give up and make iOS games. Why are they even doing this? But I think, you know, I'm not sure actually what the sales of numbers of the 2DS are. I assume that they just, on like VG charts and stuff, they just get rolled into the 3DS numbers. But the, you know, the points that people made at the time, you know, John Siracusa and people like this, it's when the device is $129, that is a substantial difference in price compared to an iPad. Like, you know, when you're just getting something for a kid, like we said before, it's like a third of the price. So yeah, definitely. So I want to do a sponsor, and then something I'm interested in is what makes a good portable game and what does not. So this episode is brought to you by Party Monster. Party Monster is a queuing DJ app for iPhone and iPad. And the basic idea is you're at a party or you're on a road trip. You want to put on some music and you don't want to babysit it. You won't want to be constantly checking like, okay, what song is coming up next? Because, you know, if you're babysitting iTunes and suddenly some bad song starts playing and you have to like cut the song and it's silence and it's just, it drives me crazy at least. And so the basic idea is that you can queue up songs, you know, tap and hold and reorder songs. You can quickly swipe to remove that Justin Bieber song that you don't want to come up and embarrass you. And it even actually has a built-in feature to not play Nickelback at all. It will not even come up on the list. So if you want to learn more about Party Monster, you can check out, just search Party Monster on the App Store. It's $1.99. So as far as, you know, obviously there's the console industry and what is going to work and not work as far as sales. But the other interesting thing to me in this arena is like what makes a good portable game and the game design decisions that go into that. So you guys were talking about like, okay, well, we have this game where you can play, let's say Fez, you can play it on the PC, you can play it on the PS4, you can pick up and play it on the Vita. How does making a game run on a portable system affect the game design choices that you need to make? And does that have, what consequences that does that have to the games that we're playing? So just like as an example, obviously you want to have a lot fewer things on screen, right? You got a lot smaller screen, you want to have fewer things on screen. And that's going to push the game design in certain ways, right? Like something like that you might be playing a game and you might consider, oh, okay, well, it would be nice to show the whole user's inventory here. Whereas on a portable game, you're like, well, just fiddling with inventory is actually probably just annoying.
I think for me, it has to be, like I mentioned it earlier, the way that the game demands your time. So a computer-based, like a home system-based game can, it may demand of you to put hours into it in a sitting. And I'm thinking of some games like Metal Gear Solid 2, which they've ported to the Vita, but I don't necessarily think is the right place for it necessarily, because it's a game that's going to mean that you will be sitting for hours because there's hours of cutscenes in the game, for example. So you will be sitting. So I think in that scenario, it's best to be like, okay, I'm going to carve out some time for this. We're going to sit at home. I'm going to sit in the front room. I'm going to sit on the sofa, my nice comfortable sofa, and we're going to play this game. And I'm going to dedicate this amount of time to it. Rather than a mobile game where, you might be picking it up for 5 minutes while you're doing something, waiting for something. You might be playing for 10 minutes on the bus and then you've got to lock it. And I mean, I know you can kind of like play it in chunks, but I don't necessarily think that's the right scenario. I think a really great mobile game is one that, you can play for 10 minutes while you're waiting in line, or you can play for 2 hours when you're on a plane. I think, and it should work equally well in both scenarios. And I think that sometimes console games are not necessarily designed to work that way.
Yeah, and I find I generally do not pick up console game ports I don't have a Vita or anything like that. But if I'm looking at iPhone and iPad games I'd like to be able to play, I mostly ignore any game that was originally intended for a console, because I expect that when I need to, do something, I need to pause the game in order to, get off the SkyTrain or the plane or get interrupted, I'm standing in line, that the games are not going to handle that gracefully. Even a game like Hearthstone, which is a really good iPad game that obviously was originally for PC, but it has this design sensibility that they obviously had iPad in mind. If you switch out to, like, you get a text message, you switch out, answer the text message, and then you go back to Hearthstone, Hearthstone is going to go, like, just start loading again from scratch. So it's
yeah,
like...
Yeah, and it quits your game.
Yeah,
it's pretty frustrating.
And then there's a loading screen, and then the pre-loading screen, and the animation, and a guy says, "Welcome," and you're like, "No, I was playing this like 3 seconds ago."
And
that's kind of a disease of games that were built for consoles, and that's partially a technical thing too, right? Like their game is assuming it's going to be able to use a few hundred megabytes of memory, and so if I switched it to the background, then iOS is going to kill it.
I think the pausability of the games is pretty key. That's the thing that's the most different about portable gaming. Even when you have the sort of kid portable gaming scenarios of, yeah, they're going to be playing this game for an hour or two. So it's not like it has to be some, dip in 5 minute play in line kind of experience. It can be a deeper experience. The thing that really is different about portable gaming from console gaming is almost all portable gaming cases, you don't have full control over how long you're going to be able to play for. When you're playing on a console, oftentimes you get to choose, okay, I just want to keep going for another 10 minutes or 15 minutes to finish this session, or I'm done playing now, so I'm going to stop and go do something else. Whereas portable gaming, even the situations where you've got a lot of time, like the long car ride scenario that I mentioned, right? If it's time for a rest stop and everyone's got to get out of the car and go pee, like, now's the time. The kids don't get to say, oh, we just want to finish watching this cutscene before we get out of the car and go pee. They have to stop the game right now and go and do that. And that's true of adults as well, right? If you're playing on the train into work, the train arrives at the time that it arrives. You don't get to, like, tell the conductor, hey, could you just slow it down a little bit so that it takes me 10 minutes longer to get to the station because I'm right in the middle of something and I don't want to stop it. You have to stop when the thing that's going on stops. And that's something that makes certain classes of games really difficult to make work effectively on mobile. You know, anything where you've got the sort of, there's a lot of stuff going on and you need to track it and you're kind of in the middle of things. And if you pause the game and then unpause it, you've got that few seconds of panic of like, what the hell is going on? Where am I? I've never tried to, but I would imagine that playing one of the classic 2D shoot 'em up games, you know, like 1942 or Air Blaster or something like that on a portable console in a scenario like that would be extremely frustrating because those games are all about tracking like dozens of things at the same time and super fine twitch movement. And it, like pausing one of those games and then coming back from being paused would just be a death sentence, right?
I've seen them try to do things like I played DS games that were really twitchy. And when you pause it and you come back, it's like, all right, press a button and then we'll start counting down. And it's like 3, 2, 1, but it's still really hard. You were just in the zone. And like, I imagine it's the same for a game like Ollie Ollie. You're upside down and in the air and you're doing a trick and there's explosions. But if it's paused and then you pick it up and you can see that the guy is upside down and there's explosions, but you're not exactly sure what direction you were pressing on the pad when you paused it. I don't know. It's kind of a bad scene. So, I mean, the only solution to that would be just don't make action games on portable consoles, but people obviously like them. So I don't know. Is there any design things that they can do? Maybe there's nothing they can do and you just have to be like, I'm only going to play an action game on a portable console if I know it's a long car trip or I'm like, you know, holed up by myself on, you know, a trip somewhere where I didn't bring my main game console or something like that. But I know I'm going to have some time where I can just sit there and focus on that.
Yeah, I think you just got to make the decision. Like I used Metal Gear Solid because it came into mind, but I actually bought it in a sale recently and it's on my Vita now. So I have Metal Gear Solid 1 and 2 on here. And I plan to play them on like a train journey. So I don't think in general they work as standard console games, like, you know, because typically I will pick up a console, like a handheld console, sorry, and play it for a few minutes here and there. But for me to want to play a game like that, I'm going to be treating it like I would treat a home console. It's just because in the scenario that I'm in, I don't have access to a home console. Like I plan to play, as I say, I plan to play it on like a long plane journey or something. So I'm treating the handheld console like a home console at that point. But I don't think that it's necessarily the best place. It isn't the best place to play that type of game, in my opinion.
Yeah, plane journeys are one that's pretty obvious for that. Like I think all of that long form gaming that I've done on iOS has actually been sort of that form, right? That I'll say, hey, I want to get one of these like PC ports to play on the plane. I did that fairly recently. We were on vacation. I recently got one of these add-on controllers for an iPhone. So it's, you know, sort of clip it on outside and it uses the new game controller interface. And so that was my plane gaming on this last trip was I was playing the port of the original Tomb Raider and a little bit of Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, both of which support it. And that was fine, but yeah, it was like I knew I had 4 or 5 hours and probably wasn't even going to want to play for that long. So, you know, start playing and play until I kind of get bored of it and the flight isn't over at that point and then do something else. So it's a situation where you don't have those interruptions, or at least you don't have them any more than you do at home where like, yeah, something can go wrong. Someone, you're in the aisle seat and someone in the middle needs to get out and that interrupts you. But, you know, those kind of unplanned interruptions can happen even if you're at home. Right.
Yeah. So,
but there's not that, like, I need to stop playing and never play again at some time that I don't have any control over in quite the same way.
Yeah. I was going to say, which one did you get?
I have the Mogo Power Ace.
And what do you think of it?
I'm kind of torn on it. I really like the idea of it, I mean, it's great to have that available, and I quite enjoyed messing around with it. It hasn't really stuck as a gaming device. Like, I got it and messed around with it a little bit, and then played it a fair bit on the one plane flight that I was sort of on most recent after it, and I haven't really hauled it out again since then. I think we were talking about this maybe last episode or the episode before, that with Tomb Raider, I'm probably not going to go back to it because the controls are so old school that it's kind of hard to play in a frustrating way. San Andreas, I might go back to at some point, but it's something that's hard to fit into my sort of way of gaming. Like, I definitely am more of a sit down console gamer. So if I'm going to play it, I either need to find a time that I'm going to have time to play mobile for a long time, or I need to make an effort to like get AirPlay streaming set up so I can watch it on TV or something like that. But I like the idea. Like, I like the idea that those kinds of experiences could be available for iOS devices. I'm just worried that it's not going to get traction, like that not enough people will get them, that you can make games that sort of target those as the primary platform. You're not even allowed to make games that are exclusive to those kind of devices. But if they got enough market penetration, you could probably make a game where you're like, yeah, the way to play this is with the gamepad. And yeah, it's got on-screen gamepad support, but it's pretty crummy. But I kind of doubt it's even going to get that much traction. The Mogo Power Ace specifically, the build quality is not very good.
Yes, that's not what I want.
If Logitech had offered one that had the like dual analog thumbsticks, I would have got it because I trust Logitech a lot more. From what I saw, like I sort of held the Logitech device in my hands and it definitely felt more solid. But it's just D-pad and four buttons, and that seems a little ridiculous to spend that much on that limited a gamepad, because they're expensive too. They're like $100 or something like that, at least more than $60. Like they've got to be double what a like gamepad for a console is. And you know, $100, like there you're getting into, you know, half the price of like a Vita. Like there, I think the Vitas are only $200 and some, aren't they?
Yeah, something like that.
So, it's a lot of money to spend for that experience. I don't know if it's going to get traction, but it would be cool if it did, because I think it would open up like a whole different realm of games that weren't available on iOS or weren't practical on iOS before.
I think the interesting thing about that especially is this idea of connecting it over AirPlay, because I played around a little bit when Nigel had San Andreas loaded up, and sure enough, yeah, it's San Andreas is dual analog, and it feels more or less right. The build quality of this particular one is not great, like you said. But the idea, if the latency could be low enough that I could play that over the Apple TV and it wasn't laggy, which I'm super skeptical. A lot of people say, no, it's fast enough now. Like, you know, we're really just about good enough on our wireless networks to be able to play a game streaming over Apple TV like that. And I'll believe it when I see it. But if they could nail that, that would be a really good solution to exactly what Mike was saying about maybe it's actually the mobile devices that live longer than the consoles.
Well, next time you're over here, ask me to fire it up for you, because it is pretty impressive. Like, it's not there yet, but when it's going fine, it's very difficult to tell that the lag is there. I mean, you can sort of notice if you're really paying super close attention, but it doesn't make the game difficult to play. The main problem that I've had with it is it hitches a bit. Not like regularly, but just you'll be playing along and then there'll be a few seconds where it'll get a little laggy and twitchy, and then it'll be back to being smooth again. And I don't know what that is. I don't know if that's something weird about my network, which is totally possible, if it's something inherent in the way they're streaming that it just gets, you know, gets behind sometime, if it's a network load issue. Something like the Wii U gamepad, like it does a really good job of streaming the video from the main console and it being totally hitch free. Like it's like you're just looking at it on your TV, but it's using some like super secret reverse engineered from crashed alien spacecraft wireless technology that is not, it's not ordinary Wi-Fi, right? And it has terrible range. Like in my house, which is old enough that it's got plaster and lathe walls, so it's all like chicken wire inside the walls, so the house is basically a huge Faraday cage. You basically can't even leave the TV room with the device without it cutting out. You know, there's some sections of the living room that's right next to the TV room that if you're sitting such that there's not a wall between you and the TV room, you're okay. But otherwise, you're kind of screwed.
I think Apple needs to get some of that secret alien technology, because I can't even, in three apartments, and now I think three different airport base stations, and I'm using the real official airport base stations too, I cannot get the AirPlay streaming just audio, which should be way less, you know, bandwidth than they have. And it still will hitch and cut out, like, not constantly, but if I'm playing music at a party and audio cuts out, like, every half an hour, that to me, that's just not worth having the convenience.
Here's the question on that. Do you have your Apple TV plugged into a wire?
I don't think that TV has
the Apple TV has an Ethernet port on it. That's the secret. Like, that's when it switched from being reasonable to being unreasonable to being reasonable for me, is we got the like network connection here redone. When was that? Like middle of last year sometime, like switched network providers and stuff like that, and changed the location of the wire coming into the house, basically. Like previously the hookup was down in the basement, and so the wireless router was there and everything was connected by wireless. And now the actual wire coming in from outside the house goes into the TV room, and the wireless router is like right there, and it's wired into the TV and the Apple TV and the game consoles. And that was when the line got crossed for me, from the streaming being totally unusable to being reasonable for all the kinds of streaming. Like video streaming and that would work because it would buffer, but it would be one of those things if you'd start playing something on the Apple TV and it would churn for 30 seconds or a minute before it would start playing. Whereas now it's like you start playing something, even if it's something coming over wireless from one of the other devices, just the difference between having half of the connection wired versus both sides of the connection wireless is enough to make the streaming reasonable.
Huh. Well, I can't do that where we are, unfortunately. Well, maybe I could drill some insane holes, but might get my handyman license revoked if I try that. Just looking at my list here, I guess one of the other things that I wanted to talk about was why it is that, and we've touched on this on previous episodes, but something I find really fascinating is that when iOS and iPad and iPhone gaming started to blossom, I was very excited about the coming AAA iOS games that, you know, we were going to have, you know, maybe not even looking at what we see AAA on a console, on a TV console, but you know what we see is the AAA games on something like the Vita and the DS. And there's been some of those, but most of them are ports, or some of them are the occasional, like we were talking about Republic, where someone really just goes out of their way. They do a Kickstarter and they put their blood, sweat, and tears into making sort of a, like what feels like a AAA type title. But it never really materialized, or at least it hasn't yet, that we have a similar ecosystem on iOS, or definitely not Android, where we have these just really polished, beautiful games that compete with film and things like that as far as production quality. Is that because it's just a fundamental limit of the fact that it's a flat screen and it doesn't have controls? Or is that more, there's so much free to wait shovelware of Clash of Farms and things like this that it's just the market gets crowded out?
I think that the lack of controls is definitely a big issue. That's why the existence of stuff like the Power Ace and those other controllers is sort of a good sign that the market could develop for those eventually, that Apple's at least committed enough to it that they're saying, yeah, there's an officially supported way to do hardware controls. There's certain classes of games that just are very limited by their control scheme, right? It's hard to make a good first-person shooter or a good third-person action game without hardware controls, and those are two of the biggest categories for AAA titles on consoles. And it's not even just consoles that you see that in. Like, you know, real-time strategy games famously are really only successful on the PC because they just need a mouse and keyboard. It's hard to make a real-time strategy game good without a mouse and keyboard, and so they've never made the jump to consoles that the rest of the industry made, and they're all still on the PC and do huge business there, even though so much of the rest of the AAA industry has now kind of moved to the consoles. So, you know, those control limitations are definitely a huge factor in why you can't have AAA games that are like the games that you had before. What iOS is starting to develop, I think, but it's taking time, is what's the iOS equivalent of that? What kind of games have that level of polish and the depth, either in terms of gameplay or in terms of kind of emotional depth? You know, how do you make those games with touch controls? And I think there are some good examples out there. I mean, the, you know, Monument Valley that we were talking about a couple weeks ago is a great example of a game that's got really high production values, but really embraces the iOS platform and the conventions of that, rather than saying, hey, let's make a game that's like the big, very polished games that we see on the consoles.
You see it the same way, Mike, that it's something that's slowly coming, but really ends up being more about the control scheme?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it can only go to a certain point. Like, the control schemes on, like, iOS devices and stuff are limited to, you know, a certain way. There's only so many things you can do with swiping, I feel. And I do think that you're able to control a lot better with console devices that have buttons on them. I feel like your options are much wider.
Could Journey have been an iPad game?
Most probably. You know, I think it could have been. I think I don't think Monument Valley would work on anything else other than the iPad or the iPhone. I think it works best on the iPad. In that guise, I mean, yeah, the Vita has a touchscreen, but it's not what it's good for. I think a game like Journey could work on the iPad because of the way it's controlled. But I feel like there are games that are tailored for certain devices, and yes, you can port them over, but there's always going to be, in my opinion, an optimum experience. Because, you know, when you start seeing a game on the iPad and it has on-screen D-pad and buttons, it tells you that it's not made for that device. Like, it's not made for it. Exactly, but it would be better on a Vita or a DS, and I think that shows it. And I think that you're starting. I don't think that there's necessarily a strong trend to show that it's moving one way or another. But every now and then, you get a great game like Monument Valley, which is perfect for the iPad.
I guess it's just sort of weird to me. It seems like I have this expectation that AAA games are going to just, you know, flower everywhere, and but in practice, in portable gaming, it seems like Nintendo is really the only company that's had like a slam dunk portable console, right? As far as games go, obviously, like iOS devices, iPhone, iPad are slam dunk as far as, you know, they sell lots of copies, but not necessarily primarily as game devices. And, you know, the Vita is, I think it's almost caught up to the Dreamcast as far as total sales, but it's not quite there yet. And so it just kind of always seems like I'm thinking, oh, yeah, this is the console that, you know, will unseat, or maybe not unseat, but at least like compete with Nintendo in a like really comparative way as far as doing high quality portable game experiences. But I don't know. Not that Monument Valley isn't high quality, but I don't know. What's your take on, as a Vita fan, what's your take on its sort of financial viability? Because like, I'm not joking, it really has not caught up to the Dreamcast as far as sales.
No, I mean, it isn't doing very well. And this is something that we actually spoke to Shahid about.
Yeah.
And, you know, their PlayStation's plan is to stick with the Vita and they're working on indie development. And I think that the console's starting to get a bit of a name for itself, because it's a great place for indie devs and it's a great place for indie games. And that's starting to appear more and more. And I think that that's going to help. I think it's going to give the console a cult following. I don't necessarily think it's going to help propel it into the general populace, you know, but it's going to give it a cult following of people like myself who will continue to buy like a new game every couple of weeks because there's all these new great games coming out. I think Sony and Nintendo need to readjust what they consider success to be in this new world, because there are a bunch of people that are only buying one device and the one device they're buying is an iPhone, an iPad, or an Android phone or an Android tablet, because they see those as the, you know, they're very, very casual gamers and they get their Candy Crush, you know? So I think that I think that embracing indie developers is a lower cost for Sony, right? Rather than needing to pay millions and millions to secure something like Titanfall. They can focus on giving great development environments, both Sony and Microsoft can, to indie developers who are willing to make less money overall, and they can just concentrate on making the best consoles that they can for the money that they want to sell them at, and just focus on creating good environments for these developers to work in. And that will help. I think that console gaming is going to change. At some point, it's going to like stabilize again, but it will stabilize at a much lower rate of sale than we've currently got. Like, you know, the PlayStation and the Xbox have done a really good job of selling. You know, like last week, 7 million PlayStations 4s have been sold. But over time, I do think that's going to change, especially for handhelds.
And one of the ways that it might stabilize is just some of the competitors being taken out, which the console market can sort of afford that, in that there's three people. If the handheld market has a shakeout of a platform actually leaving, it's going to have to be the PSP and the Vita, right? Like, there's no one else. And although I'm not a huge fan of the Vita as a gaming device, like, I think it's nice to have competition. Like, it's nice to have that market, and it's nice to have something that is targeted at grown-ups a little more, right? I mean, the fact that it's kid targeted has been really successful for Nintendo, and I think that underestimating that was one of the mistakes that Sony made with the PSP and the Vita, is that they sort of assumed that there were enough grown-ups that wanted a good portable gaming experience to support them, and there turned out not to be. But it's nice to have that option. I don't know if the numbers are there. Like, I don't know if it's actually viable. Certainly the current sales numbers for the Vita do not suggest that it is. I'm looking at this week's VG charts thing here, and the Vita is still being outsold by the PS3, you know, never mind the Xbox One or the 3DS or the PS4, like one of the last gen consoles is still outselling it. So, it's going to be tough to fight back from that. I think it would be cool if they could, because it'd be nice to have that niche filled, but maybe the niche just isn't big enough.
All right. Well, I think that's good coverage of our topic. Thanks for listening, and huge thanks to Mike for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure, guys. Thank you so much. I'm a fan of the show, so thank you for having me.
Excellent. Well, we're fans of your show, so we're actually show cousins, because we coincidentally started gaming podcasts the same week. I was like, oh, there's no game podcast on 5x5, and that's sort of what I think of as the type of audience that we, you know, people who are either technical or developer, sort of Apple centric, loosely. And so we're like, oh, let's do a game podcast. And then it's like, oh, we've all edited it out. We got 4 episodes in the can. And then it's like, Mike Hurley's like, hey, cool, I got a gaming podcast. Like, of course you do. Of course you do. but it's been awesome to listen to. And, the format's different, so it's awesome.
We're tied together forever.
Exactly. So if you'd like to hear Mike on his other 476 podcasts, you can check out www.5by5.tv. Or find them on Twitter as iMike, iMYKE. Cheers.
Thanks, guys.
And now our theme music plays, and we can talk about things other than portable gaming if we want.
I love your theme music as well.
Oh, really? Thanks. I like yours too. Was it always the same since the beginning, or is it just grown on me, the direction?
Yeah, no, it's always been the same. We have an intro and an outro, which are slightly different, but same composer. It was the guy responsible for the Ridiculous Fishing music.
And, oh, awesome.
Yeah, and Super Crate Box and Spelunky. His name's completely gone out of my head right now, so I'm going to check these things. But yeah, Federico was able to get us hooked up on that, which was kind of awesome.
That's awesome. Our theme song comes from a band called I Fight Dragons, which is a Chicago-based 8-bit rock band.
Yep, I'm familiar with them, actually. Oh, I've heard them before, yeah.
Had you heard the song before?
I don't think so.
Maybe I had. The interesting thing about that song is that, and there's a YouTube video where he goes on like this crazy rant about it, where they got signed to a record label, and they were very excited, like, okay, great, we're going to get 8-bit music to the masses. And so they were playing around and recorded a few songs, and this one song that's the intro to an outro to our show, he just did the music to it, not like a full arrangement and no lyrics or vocals for it, or melody for the vocals. And so, but they were pretty excited, and it was like late one night. And so he just sent a demo of just a couple of those tracks to the label, like, hey, we're working on this thing, we're pretty excited about it. And the label freaked out, and they're like, that's going to be a hit, it's going to be a mega hit. All right, we're really excited to hear it. And so then he like thought about it and wrote some vocals and some lyrics and sent it off, and they're like, no, that's not a hit. There's a hit there, though. So they actually forced him for like a span of like 2 years, or maybe it was only a year, but like 10 different iterations of the song, like rewriting it and rewriting it and rewriting it, bringing in various guest writers and guest vocalists. They got Rivers Cuomo to actually write a version of the song. And in the end, they're just like, yeah, no, it's not going to work. And then they just like never published the song. So they're not on a label anymore. They don't like labels.
It's Eric Cerchi at Strucci.
Eric Cerchi.
Eric at Strucci on Twitter. He did the music for us.
Yep. That's awesome. But yeah, I emailed them. I'm like, hey, do you mind if I use this thing that was never published and is not actually? And they're like, yeah, that's awesome. So I don't know how up on the up. And I mean, technically, maybe the label actually owns it. I mean, probably, but
eh. Don't worry about it.
It's the internet. I'm not the worst violator of that stuff. So cool. Anything else you're excited about that you're playing, Mike?
I've been playing Hearthstone, which is fun. It is definitely fun. It does suffer from the fact that it has to be connected at all times.
Oh, do you have it's on the subway or what have you, want to play on the iPad and doesn't work?
Yeah, or like the plane. Like I was away and I had a plane journey. I wanted to play Hearthstone, but you can't. It would be nice if they just had a mode where you could play.
Yeah, you should be able to play against the computer or whatever, right?
Yeah, because they have a mode where you can play against the computer, but you have to be connected to play it, which is really weird. I don't get that.
Is that like achievements, maybe?
Yeah, it's stupid. I don't know, and there's just a bunch of video games that I enjoy, like Luftrausers and Fez. I've started playing Hotline Miami again, which is an amazing game. They've got a sequel coming out at some point soon.
Yeah, that seems like a particularly well-suited game for the Vita.
It's perfect. And they're actually releasing it, if they haven't already, for the PlayStation as well, like for the big console. What else have I been playing? Have you checked out Hitman Go?
Hitman Go.
That's on my list. Oh. I saw the announcement about it and like put it on my short list of iPad games to pick up, but I've not tried it yet. It looks really cool.
I have never played a game that looks or acts the way this game does. It's insane. The person who had this idea must have got a huge raise. This is just one of those things. It's like, well, this is obvious.
So what's the idea? I have not seen this, Hitman Go.
So you're familiar with Hitman, right?
Yes.
So basically, they've set this one out like it's a board game.
Okay.
So you basically, it's kind of, your movements are on rails. And every character, including you and all the others, are like board game pieces. And as you move, they take a move as well. So everybody's moving at one time. I'm sure that it is based on a specific type of game that I don't know the name of, you know, like a real world game. So you kind of just, every time you make a move, somebody else moves, you move, they move. And it's like, you're kind, it's kind of like a cross between like a board game and chess, and you have set amount of moves, but set amount of places you can go, and you have to kind of like make your moves to kill people. Like, so when you cross somebody's path, you knock their piece over and their piece falls down, which means they're dead. And you like had to pick up like a briefcase, and there's like different challenges per levels, but just the art style and the way that the game is played is so unique. It's, it really, really is an interesting game.
This looks very cool. This is exactly the type and style of iPad game that I like.
Yeah, me too.
You know, it has enough action that it keeps going, but it has a certain amount of sort of board gaminess to it.
Well, it's just, it's more than anything. It's like, this was a game that was made for the iPad.
Yeah.
Like, Hitman is a, like, they say, oh, like a Hitman game's coming to the iPad. Well, we all know how rubbish that's going to be, you know?
Yeah, I wouldn't even have paid attention to that.
And then it's like, oh, but these are the images. What? You know, it's just like, what have you done here? It's really, really interesting. It gets hard really fast. Well, at least I think it does. But it's like a strategy game, and I'm looking forward to playing more of it. And they've just done some really interesting stuff. Like, the art style is so attractive. I find it so attractive. And like, all of the levels are in like boxes, you know, like a board, it's in like a box, and you tap it and like the box opens and then the level's there and you play it.
That's awesome. I love that.
I like it a lot. Yeah, so it's really, really cool. I've been enjoying that one.
It doesn't get really hard because then you have to like buy in-app purchases, not die, does it?
No. I think you pay for it, and then, yeah, it's just like a pay-for game. I don't even think it has in-app purchases. I'm going to the App Store now to find out. Yeah, in-app
purchases.
They
actually have that label now on the phone, at least, that every single game that has in-app purchases, besides free, it says free and underneath in-app purchases.
Oh, wait, no, it's $2.99.
Yeah.
And you can buy hints, but you don't need those. You know, you're getting stuck, you can get hints. And then they also have, like, DLC. So, like,
okay.
$69. Well, it's £2.99, so it's probably, like, $5. And then, like, it's probably, like, 99 cents to unlock additional chapters. I'm fine with that, by the way, you know.
Oh yeah,
that, I have no problem paying for more levels and stuff, as long as you get a good amount right out of the box. But it's the other stuff that I have issues with.
DLC started off as this thing that got so much hate from the game community, and like, oh, they're making us pay for more of the game and they're just trying to screw us. And then within like two or three years, and seeing all the horrible things that were happening with in-app purchase and, you know, coins and gems and stuff like that, now it's just like, oh, hey, cool, it has DLC, you can actually pay for more of the game.
Please let me add DLC. yeah,
that's changed.
See, I feel like this is the right way to do in-app purchase, like the hints thing, right? Well, all it's doing is just, if you're smart enough, just be smart enough and you don't have to pay. I'm kind of cool with that, you know, where it's like, you can, like, it's like the Angry Birds model. You can pay to have the level completed for you, but, or you can just put the work in.
My take on that is, and the thing that really splits me being okay with or not okay with an in-app purchase is generally when it's consumable. If it's a thing that you unlock that's content or even an ability, I think of that as content. I think of that as a thing I get. But if you're just giving me something that I can just consume and spend that is going to create a treadmill of suck, then it just makes me angry that you even offer. If I even see gems or coins or anything. And I know sometimes really it's like, okay, well, you have gems, but then you could just use the gems to buy various level content inside the app. But I think that's just blurring lines that shouldn't be blurred.
Treadmill of suck is fantastic.
That's what it is, though.
No, I agree.
Gems.
Our first episode was about in-app purchase, and I think probably 50% of the episodes we complain about it. Just like that's the season long story arc for us, right? That's our big bad for this podcast. Yep. Is in-app purchases.
Well, they're a scourge on the gaming industry. Like, there's no other way to, you know, there's no other way to put it. It's a bad thing in a lot of scenarios. Yeah, it
kind of is.
Have you guys seen David Smith's underscore David Smith's thing about how to improve the App Store and in-app purchases and things like that?
Yeah, that was recently a pretty good list of suggestions there, I thought.
I haven't read that yet, but it's on my list, yeah.
In the show notes. But it's definitely, so some of his suggestions are things like making it so when you are offered an in-app purchase and you click to buy it, It tells you how much money you've already spent on that game. So if you've already spent $100 of gems in Candy Crush and then you click to buy more gems, it will say like, would you like to buy more gems for 99 cents? So far you've spent $100 in Candy Crush. And then users can be like, holy shit, like, why am I doing this?
You can make your own decision at that point.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not telling you can't. It's just making it, dumbing down or sort of diluting that ability for people to just get people into this mental state where they keep buying and buying and buying without realizing it.
Yep.
Another thing that they had on there, that he had on there, was making it so that you could see games and apps that had been reviewed previously or by Apple, like if they had been featured, which I think is cool personally just because we have apps that have been featured. So, but they are featured for a week or two and then it goes away. But it would be nice to get like little achievements on your app, like,
oh, that's
hey,
cool.
This was featured, or this was featured as like a great road trip app. And it would be cool. And I would like to see that as a user too, being able to, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's some good stuff that apply to games as well.
Guys, I'm afraid I have to leave you.
Ah, cool.
But it's been a pleasure, and I hope you'll have me back again someday.
Yeah, we'd love to. Thanks for coming on.